dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. One of its finest practitioners, I'm very pleased to say, is former Assistant Secretary of State Robert Charles. He has been working in various governmental and non-governmental capacities for many years, advancing our national interests, most recently during the George W. Bush administration, where he was working on, among other things, narcotics and law enforcement issues at the State Department. But you see him a lot at Fox News and read him there and, among other places, at the Association for Mature American Citizens, a very, very active contributor to the public policy debate. We're always delighted to pick his brains. He's also the author of a terrific book, Eagles and Evergreens. Bobby Charles, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you very much, Frank. Ready to roll.
Good. We had some conversations previously, I think, about this, but I'd like to double back with you on Syria in light of recent developments there. Bobby, you've written at the AMAC website about the implications of what happened, and I'd like to just get your sense of, you know, the nature of our obligations to the Kurds as you see them and the implications of having more or less walked away from those obligations.
Yeah, we're in a very difficult moment here, and that piece tried to articulate that. The moment is characterized by, it's a complex issue. I mean, Syria and the Kurds go back for almost a millennium. And the sad part here is that we made pledges to the Kurds and they counted on those pledges. And those pledges involved not abandoning them after they had assisted us in extinguishing ISIS. So you have multiple layers of unintended consequences that emerge when you make what amounts to a firm decision that you're going to pull American troops out. Understood, that's trying to get Americans home, and a lot of Americans think that's a good idea. And we also have a NATO ally on paper and in historic practice in Turkey. And we have a base at Incirlik, and we have a base at Izmir, and we use those bases well and often. And, you know, we're signed up with Article 5 in the NATO treaty to be able to support one another. But, you know, several ugly things have occurred here, and they all have unintended consequences. The first is that there was a pullback immediately of a small number of Americans, which seemed like a green light for Erdogan, who is an Islamist of the first order, who's consolidated power in Turkey, who admires the Ottoman Empire. And he then turned around and summarily put troops on the ground further into Syria. And that has caused all kinds of grief. And of course, the president may very well not have intended that. He was in the transition between national security advisors. This may have been a plan earlier on that just got executed now. But the implications are severe. One is for the Kurds. Obviously, we need to now understand how do we protect our former fighting allies on the ground there to the extent we can at all. The second is Turkey's become adventurous, and we need to stop that. The third is the Russians, of course, have supported Assad, and there's some conflict potentially brewing there. And the biggest implication, in my view, is the biggest unintended consequence you saw this morning with a Chinese former current senior official arguing that the United States should not get in the way, or implying it, he's talking about the United States should not even get in the way if they should decide to take Taiwan. So I think the problem is that when you raise doubts, even unintentionally, with your allies about your staying power, it creates ambitions in the minds of bad actors around the world that would threaten your allies. And I will just say that in World War II, despite the fact that the lines were seemingly clean and clear, we had a lot of disagreements with France. We had a lot of disagreements with some of the individuated members of the fighting forces, but we never backed away from our allies. We stayed strong with them. So we've got a difficulty here.
I'm afraid it's going to get tougher in the not too distant future, Bobby Charles. Let me just pick up on this point that you've just made, because it's very important, I think, for our audience to understand what this Chinese defense minister, Wei Fengji, has said. And that is that the greatest national interest of China is the Taiwan question, and that no force could prevent China's reunification with Taiwan. That's pretty clearly a throwdown to the United States, I think, as the principal impediment to the realization of China's ambitions to bring Taiwan, if necessary, forcibly back into its control. The question that I guess occurs is, if there were to be a reprise of the sort of thing that we're told happened with Erdogan, where the Turkish president told President Trump, we're coming in to Syria in force, and basically, you better get your guys out of the way or they're likely to be ground up. If that similar kind of comment were made by Xi Jinping to President Trump, whether he might respond similarly by, you know, making sure that American forces were not in the way. And the consequences of that, Bobby Charles, is, as you know, would extend far beyond the immediate fate of the people of Taiwan. This would be of huge, huge consequence in the wider region, would it not?
Well, as always, Frank, you are ahead of the curve and you are absolutely right. And that call from Xi to Trump, I hope never happens. Remember that the very first phone call this president made, I'm sure that the Democrats wanted to leak it. In fact, I'm seeming to remember that someone leaked it, was to the leader of Taiwan, which was an unprecedented act of support.
Actually, I think he took a congratulatory call from her, but that was a first too.
Okay, perhaps that was the origins. You know, also note, well, but I also want to note that the relationship goes back, our tie to Taiwan. I mean, Ronald Reagan made it very clear that we were supporting Taiwan and that no harm should come to them. I see this in a dramatic sort of sequence. I mean, I think the reason the comment came out of China this morning is because it's two things. It's because of the way that we backed out of the way and let Erdogan move forward in Syria, which was probably unintended or unanticipated fully. But I think knowing Erdogan, we should have anticipated it. And the second piece of this is that you could see a sequence where the Chinese decide they've had enough in Hong Kong. They crack down in Hong Kong. There's world condemnation for that act. It's Tiananmen version 2. And they decide, well, since we're in the mode of being condemned anyway, we're going to take the next step and initiate something against Taiwan. I think it would be a terrible mistake. I think Taiwan would fight to the last man, and I think it would be a horrific turn of events for global affairs. But that is why we lean on the idea of deterrence. That's why we keep our allies close. That's why we keep our enemies well informed about the closeness that we and our commitments, and we keep our commitments to our allies. I mean, it's sort of 101, but I do think that this is a very curious statement out of the senior defense official from China. And to me, it implies that they were watching world events very closely and they saw exactly what happened in Syria, and they're rattling the saber.
Yeah. Bobby Charles, thank you so much for your time today. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about developments in China and the possibility of that miscalculation we've been talking about being made. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined as we have the high privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang, one of our country's preeminent experts and most highly regarded commentators on what's happening in China and Asia more generally. He joins us each week, I'm very pleased to say, bringing to bear the insights that he has popularized in countless interviews and published pieces, but also his three terrific books. The Coming Collapse of China, nuclear showdown, North Korea takes on the world, and most recently losing South Korea. You can follow him at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No, thank you so much, Frank.
Gordon, I thought I might start with a kind of breaking news item that the United States government in the past day or two has actually insisted on reciprocity in at least one regard, and that is with respect to the latitude that diplomats have had in our country, diplomats from China specifically, have had in our country to go where they will or talk with whom they wish without even having to give our government some kind of heads up about it. Very different treatment than American diplomats have been subjected to and are still being subjected to. Talk about it if you would.
Yeah. American diplomats in China may not meet Chinese nationals without getting permission from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. In the United States, Chinese diplomats up to now have been able to see whoever they want and no reporting requirements whatsoever. Thankfully, we are now imposing at least some restrictions. We're now requiring a notification. But what we really need to do is go full reciprocity. In other words, treat the Chinese diplomats the same way they treat ours. I know that Beijing has said that our imposition of this new restriction is a violation of the Vienna Treaty, but that's ridiculous. And indeed, I think because we have seen Chinese diplomats repeatedly and systematically violate American sovereignty in activities that are inconsistent with their status here, and I'm not talking just about spying, I'm talking about attempts to intimidate Americans, I actually think we should be closing China's five consulates in the U.S. and sending most of the embassy staff in Washington packing back to Beijing. We really don't need these agents on our soil, and we'd be a lot better if we took down their consulates.
How many consulates does the United States have in China? Do you know, Gordon?
We have, I believe, about five. The Chinese have five in the U.S., and I actually think that considering what happened last year when China was either a perpetrator of or complicit in causing the brain injuries to our diplomats at the Guangzhou consulate, I think we should be closing our consulates in China. We can't protect them there. So obviously we need to bring them back. People may scream about this, but the point is, if the Chinese insist on injuring Americans, we have no choice but to bring our people back.
You know, Gordon, I'm so glad you mentioned that story. It has gotten far too little attention to my way of thinking. This is, of course, something similar to what has happened in Cuba, and it got a bit more attention there. But this has involved real harm to American diplomats who are exposed to some sort of sonic attack, it seems, and there has been no accountability for it, as best I can tell, and it seems to me you're absolutely right. There ought to be a reciprocal, closure of these kinds of facilities. But reciprocity more generally ought to be the principle, I think. Which brings me to the two examples that we've talked about from time to time. And I'd just ask you to discuss it with us in this context, Gordon. The so-called Confucius Institutes on American campuses, over 100 of them, I think, at last count. Though that number is somewhat smaller than it used to be, thank heavens. But also this practice of the Chinese buying advertising supplements, which to the untutored eye may not appear to be advertising supplements at all, but that are sort of outlets for Chinese propaganda in places like the New York Times and the Washington Post. Is there any comparable opportunity for American outlets in China?
No, there isn't. And this issue raises the issue of access. Chinese state media has access and puts their programming on U.S. cable networks. We cannot do the same. There is CNN and maybe, I think there's just CNN for restricted sites like hotels for foreigners, but that's about it. CNN, Fox, MSNBC, Bloomberg can't generally put their programming on Chinese channels. So that needs to be changed as well. There's all sorts of issues with reciprocity that goes up and down the whole spectrum of our relations with Beijing. We have not required it. We need to, at least at the minimum. There are other things that we need to do, of course, but you start with reciprocity.
Well, and the other piece of that is, of course, that it's Chinese government propaganda, basically, that is being pushed out in these platforms. The Voice of America, for example, has no comparable opportunity to, well, propagandize, assert our view of the world or our news, for that matter, to the Chinese people. And this is another place where I think, as you've said, the need for reciprocity is acute. Gordon, let me switch to a different topic. The Federal Retirement Thrift Investment Board, mouthful to be sure, is, I believe, going to be taking stock today, if I can use that term, or perhaps a week from today, on a very controversial issue. And a good colleague of ours and friend, Christopher Iacovella, who is the president of the American Securities Association, has written an important piece in Real Clear Politics today, entitled, Why Are American Investors Funding Chinese Fraud? And one of the particular concerns here is that that's happening with a lot of American investors, but depending on what happens with this thrift savings plan, as it's called, the federal retirement system, American government employees, federal government employees, and military personnel may be forced, basically, to make similar investments in not just fraudulent Chinese companies, but some that are doing very bad business indeed. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, we should not be putting federal money into China. You know, President Trump raised the possibility of cutting off investment flows to China, and a lot of people just wailed about that. But, you know, China is that's enriching China. That's helping a country that is configuring its military to kill Americans, that has injured Americans, not only the diplomats with the sonic attacks. They caused the eye injuries to those two C-130 pilots last April. So there's all sorts of issues here why we should not be enriching Beijing right now. And then there's the other issue that you alluded to, and that is that Chinese companies have not been providing full information to American companies, as American companies are required to do. So that is just, again, wrong. So there's a whole bunch of investment issues here. But I think the best thing to do is to cut off this flow of investment, because we do not need to be feeding our enemy.
Indeed. And Gordon, on the point you've just made about the lack of reciprocity, might we say, about Chinese companies in our markets, the reason that we're told the SEC does not require them to meet the same standards as American companies have to under Sarbanes-Oxley and Dodd-Frank is their audits are state secrets, which suggests to me there's a problem here, don't you think? Quite apart from the fact that who knows what Americans are actually investing in. It's a real pig in a poke, if I can use that expression. Which brings me to another topic, just quickly. What is the latest, Gordon Chang, on the African swine fever problem that seems to be decimating the Chinese pork industry, which is a huge staple of the Chinese diet, is it not?
It certainly is. Pork is the primary meat in China. African swine fever has resulted in the culling of about half of China's pigs. It's also, of course, had knock-on effects because it's Ghana, corn production in China has also suffered because there's no need for much of the corn that has been produced because the corn was used to feed pigs. So it is affecting agriculture as well. This is a problem for China, of course. They've got to buy pork from other countries, including the United States. And it's causing a big increase in prices in China, which is inflation, of course. So there are effects that ripple through the Chinese economy, and none of them are good.
You know, Gordon, one other thing that I was told the other day is that the United States, I think customs folks, intercepted a shipment of something like 1 million pounds of Chinese pork, which had been infected with this disease. And I'm told that the virus, this fever, can actually persist in frozen meat for, well, indefinitely, I guess, basically, which could cause a problem of introducing that very, very deadly disease to our own pork population if we're not careful. It seems as though this is just another example of very bad behavior on the part of the Chinese. Any thoughts?
Yes, well, certainly African swine fever has spread outside China. There's believed to be an epidemic in North Korea, for instance. And, you know, we're going to see this in other countries as well. The last thing we want to do is see it in the United States. And we ought to stop in the import of Chinese food, just largely because of the reasons that you say. We cannot guarantee its safety and its and the rest of it. So if this is a whole issue of our relations with China that need to be reassessed. Vice President Pence is going to give his long-awaited second China speech next week at the Wilson Center, I believe. And this is going to be a seminal event because his first speech last year at the Hudson Institute was an important document.
It was indeed, and it's still reverberating, I think, in Beijing. Let's hope that he will be at least as bracing to them and touch on some of these vital issues of reciprocity and bad behavior on the Chinese part. Gordon, as always, thank you. I hope you'll come back to us again next week. Next up, we will talk with Greg Scarlatiou straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Greg Scarlatiou is one of America's preeminent figures where it comes to both understanding and championing human rights and the threat thereto, emanating from the North Korean regime of Kim Jong-un. He is the executive director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. He is also the vice president of the executive board of the International Council on Korean Studies and an instructor at the U.S. State Department's Foreign Service Institute, focusing on Korea and Japan. He has, among other things, been writing a column since 2003 for Radio Free Asia, titled The Scarlatiou Column, about North Korea. He is, among other things, the Citizen of Honor of the city of Seoul in South Korea back in 1999. And a good friend of this program. We're always pleased to have him. Welcome back, Greg.
Always good to be back, Frank.
Well, I want you to help unpack a somewhat mysterious report that came to my attention from the Voice of America involving Kim Jong-un riding a white horse on the snow of the country's highest mountain. What are we to make of all of this?
Well, this is certainly part of the forging of a new cult of personality for the grandson of the country's founder, Kim Il-sung. Of course, ever since Kim Jong-un took over in December 2011, after his father died, the regime, its propaganda and agitation department, and its organization and guidance department have had a fairly tough time forging this new cult of personality for a variety of reasons. Number one, the mother of Kim Jong-un was an ethnic Korean from Japan. The mother is very important within the world of North Korea. The spouse is also very important. Now, in North Korea's loyalty-based system of social classification, ethnic Koreans from Japan rank very low, thus added difficulty to creating this new cult of personality for a new leader. Moreover, the father, Kim Jong-il, had 20 years to prepare to take over the helm of North Korea, 1974 to 1994, July 1994, when his father, Kim Il-sung, died. In the case of Kim Jong-un, he barely had 3 years to prepare. Number three, when the father took over the rule of North Korea, he was 53 years old. Kim Jong-un was only 27. He turned 28 the following month, January of 2012. You see pictures of Kim Jong-un shooting pistols, emerging from the hatch of a tank. Now, Kim Jong-un riding a white horse, climbing up Mount Paektu. Of course, this type of imagery, experts have argued, was borrowed from the Japanese imperial days. And one can look at pictures of a former Japanese emperor next to on a white horse next to Kim Jong-un on a white horse to see that there's certainly a connection there.
Somewhat ironic, given the hostility towards the Japanese of the North Koreans, no?
Yes, and North Koreans have known nothing but totalitarian political systems prior to the communist takeover in 1945 and the establishment of the DPRK, the Communist Republic, in 1948. This was preceded by 40 years of very brutal, ruthless Japanese imperial occupation, 1905 to 1945. Before that, 500 years of feudal Joseon Dynasty. There are a lot of wonderful things about the Joseon Dynasty, but nevertheless, this is a totalitarian, very oppressive political system, especially in the 19th century. Thus, the Kim family regime equals Stalinist communism plus elements borrowed from the Japanese imperial period plus elements borrowed from the time Korea was a feudal dynasty plus, of course, the added spin that the Kims gave it to create this human rights nightmare that we witness today.
Yeah. Now, just going back to this particular story about this cult of personality effort, there is something in this report about the North Korean leader promising a world wonder, as he puts it. What would you anticipate that might entail, Greg Scarlett?
Communist leaders have promised their people world wonders at every step of the way. Life is always going to be better, not now, but 10 years from now. The economy is going to improve, not now, but 5 years from now. I have no idea what the world wonder is, but given the current state of North Korea, I doubt that it can be anything wonderful for the people of North Korea or anything wonderful for mankind. The only things that the North Korean regime is able to produce properly appear to be its tools of death. It's ballistic missiles, weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons.
Right. And we may have reason to fear that there will be more announcements about breakthroughs on that front. Let me turn to another challenge facing the North Korean people. I spoke in the previous segment with Gordon Chang about this phenomenon of African swine fever that is devastating not just the Chinese pig population, but that of other nations in Asia. As I understand it, there's been exactly one reported case of this fever in North Korea. He, however, expects that there's actually an epidemic underway there as well. What's your take on that, and what might the implications be for people who don't have enough food under the best of circumstances, should their pig population be similarly wiped out?
I have seen reports that contaminated pigs have actually attempted to cross the DMZ into South Korea. The South Korean perception is that this is so serious that they have deployed snipers to the DMZ to take down swine, pigs, and wild hogs that might be contaminated. This is a highly secretive regime. This is a regime that refuses to disclose its real national statistical data. It's a regime that's good at distorting data. It's not interested in collecting the real data. So this is indeed a very dangerous situation. Even when dealing with a country as closed and secluded as North Korea, when it comes to infectious disease can surely cross even the DMZ or can even go back and forth the northern border of China. So I would say that this underlines the fact that the very presence of the Kim regime on the Korean Peninsula presents a threat to South Korea, to other neighbors on multiple levels, including this level of public health.
Yeah. Well, to say nothing of the people of North Korea, let me ask you about them. You have just published, I believe, a very important paper entitled The Health and Human Rights of North Korean Children, 1990 to 2018, The Lost Generation. It's written by Cortland Robinson and other authors. Give us a flavor of what it says about, among other things, the famine that has afflicted the people of North Korea now for decades, and the toll that it has taken on at least one generation and arguably many.
This is a very comprehensive report relying on the collection, interpretation, and analysis of vast amounts of data, more than 60 interviews with subjects who experienced the Great Famine of the 1990s. It is a truly comprehensive study, which the Telegraph, Julian Ryle, described as the most comprehensive study on the health of North Korean people after the end of the Cold War. The human rights situation and the human security situation, including the health situation of North Korean children, is dire. The regime blamed the Great Famine of the 1990s on natural disasters, on flooding. The fact of the matter is that, as Marcus Nolan and Steph Haggard pointed out a few years ago, and they're quoted in this report, what the regime did in the 1990s was the following. As foreign aid began to come in, they stopped importing food. In other words, they used foreign aid as a tool to adjust their balance of payments. Money is fungible. They spent money not on food for their people or children, but on their nuclear program, their missile program, and, for example, on purchasing used MiG fighters from Central Asian republics. So if they had continued to import food at the same levels, the crisis, the famine, would not have lasted for as long, and fewer people certainly would have died or have been affected by this great catastrophe. This famine took a very heavy toll on an entire generation of North Koreans. Thus, the title of the report, Lost Generation. The regime focuses all of its resources, all of the available resources, on areas that are critical to the survival of the regime: nukes, missiles, tools of death, keeping the elites happy by granting them access to luxury goods from the outside world. In the process, it has no qualms about sacrificing its own people. It had no qualms about sacrificing an entire generation of North Korean children. They did it in the blink of an eye.
Yeah. And it's a case study, really, isn't it, of the best of intentions on the part of Western nations to provide help to the North Korean people, of that help being expropriated and misused and their plight made vastly worse, arguably, by their own government. And, you know, Greg, I'm given to say that any government that treats its own people this badly is unlikely to treat ours, or for that matter, others, any better. And as we're looking at the behavior of North Korea, especially, as you say, their use of whatever funds they have to amass means of mass destruction, increasingly, we believe, capable of inflicting that mass destruction intercontinentally, namely to our own shores, that we have to take this very seriously and have to be on guard against the dangers of this regime. Nobody does this better than you do at the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Thanks so much, my friend. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with Lawrence Peck. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're going to continue focusing on North Korea with one of the people who studies it very closely at the North Korean Freedom Coalition, where he is an advisor. His name is Lawrence Peck. Very, very capable, independent researcher who has focused, among other things, on what North Korea is doing in South Korea and in our own country in the way of its influence operations. But before we get to that, let me welcome him. And I'm very pleased that you're back, Lawrence. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me again on. It's been a little while since we spoke, and it's a pleasure to be able to speak to your audience again.
Altogether too long. We're glad to close the gap there. Let me just ask you just a word on North Korea's situation. We're hearing that Kim Jong-un is poised to make some wonder announcement. And I just wonder if you have any idea what that might entail. Greg Scarlett, you was unclear. Any thoughts on your part?
Well, if Greg is unsure, and he's far more erudite on the topic than myself, it's hard to pin it down. I know most of our best brains on the topic also are unsure, but there seems to be a consensus of opinion that some kind of announcement or surprise move may be coming from the North, and we fear it may be somewhat of a further aggressive nature.
Yeah, I fear so too. Let's turn to what is going on in part as a result of the influence operations that North Korea has been engaged in for a long time in South Korea, and specifically under this president, Moon Jae-in. You were in South Korea recently, participating in the Conservative Political Action Conference there. And in the approximate window of that meeting, there have been some very massive demonstrations against Moon. Give us a sense of what is happening inside this nation with whom we're closely allied and yet seemingly are increasingly at odds with its government.
Yes, I was just in Seoul just a couple of weeks ago to participate in the first annual, and hopefully the first of many to come, Korea Political Action Conferences. And that was attended by about at least 1,200 people, 1,200 great Korean conservative pro-U.S. activists. And we had speakers, of course, from the American Conservative Union and related organizations there.
And what is going on against the backdrop of that meeting with respect to Moon Jae-in? I think you have expressed some strong concerns about his loyalties, shall we say. I'm interested in what that looks like at the moment, as well as the popular response to that policy.
Yes, it just so happens that October 3rd, the date that conservative conference was held, conservative pro-U.S. forces in Korea, anti-North Korea, anti-Moon forces, held one of the biggest mass demonstrations in Korean history. Perhaps close to a million people, if not more, was held in downtown Seoul. The streets were just literally all of downtown filled with a sea of American and South Korean flags being waved. Of course, the figures vary. The estimates is always hard to judge the crowd sizes, but it could have in anywhere from, let's say, 700,000 to a million or more. And this was in protest against the Moon regime, and specifically over an issue of an appointee to the cabinet by Moon, which we can get into.
Yeah. Well, this bespeaks, I gather, a larger plummeting of his popular approval. And in part, as you say, that's a function of his appointment of a fellow by the name of Cho Kuk to the Justice Ministry. Tell us about him.
Yes, the reason why Moon's approval rating has sunk down, according to some polls, of the low 40s and other polls even into the 30% range, his approval rating, is because he nominated and then appointed to the position of a justice minister. And of course, in Korea, your listeners may not be aware that that does not approve any kind of that does not require, rather, any kind of legislative approval as it would here for a cabinet level post. But he named this fellow by the name of Cho Guk, Cho being the family name, who had a rather shady past, shall we say, and whose current situation was complicated by the fact that he was accused of being involved in various corruption on behalf of his family, both financial and in terms of obtaining preferential treatment, for example, for his daughter. But there's an ideological element to it about the background of Cho, which I'd like to mention briefly.
Yeah, well, just to put a cap on the absurdity of his appointment, he was appointed, among other things, to reform the office of the prosecutor who was actually investigating him and his family, as I understand it. Is that right?
Yes, precisely. For the corruption allegations and the preferential treatment allegations and certain accusations of shady business dealings. But perhaps even more bizarre than that, in an ironic sense, was the fact that he'd also been in trouble with the justice system in Korea back in the early 1990s, because he had been at that time, and remember, this the early 1990s was after the restoration of full democratic rule in South Korea. So you had a functioning democracy there. Yet at that time, he had joined and became an active member of a Marxist-Leninist revolutionary group known as the Socialist Workers Alliance or Socialist Workers League, which had as its stated purpose, its stated goal, to overthrow the South Korean government and replace it with a Marxist-Leninist dictatorship. And the group would speak, for example, in its writings about eliminating the bourgeoisie and fighting to the last drop of their blood. This this is a group, by the way, which had experimented with poisons in order to kill themselves if they were caught, which was seeking to gather weapons and make explosives in order to stage this armed communist revolution. And he was part of this group, and it as recently as the early 1990s.
Wow. Sounds like he should have been in jail, not in the Justice Department, needless to say.
Well, he was for a while. He was for a while, and then he went on to Berkeley to get his law degree there.
Oh, well, that makes everything fine. There have been some who have said that it was actually regrettable that he resigned from the Justice Ministry, Lawrence Peck, because he was such a lightning rod for the opposition to Moon and his policies. And I guess that's really the crux of this, isn't it? It's not just this individual. It's not just his background. It's not just his conflicts of interest. It was the fact that he really represented in a very vivid way the kind of anti-American, pro-North Korean policies of Moon Jae-in. And in his absence, is it likely that the outpouring of opposition to his government that you just described will dissipate, or do you think it will continue to build?
Well, yes, to emphasize your point, he didn't just pop out of nowhere. He had been working in the Blue House, the presidential office of President Moon, and was an advisor to him, and then had been plucked out from that position to serve as the Justice Ministry. So he's one of this coterie of people surrounding Moon who in the past, and there have been several of them, have been pro-North Korean, anti-U.S. radicals, sometimes involved with violent groups. But as you alluded to the fact that some of the pro-U.S. conservative activist forces in Korea, some including some friends and colleagues of mine, have indicated that, in a sense, they were almost reluctant to see his nominee or to see him resign because the nomination and his naming as justice minister had been a lightning rod of conservative opposition to Moon. People were so enraged that you had these situations that I alluded to where hundreds of thousands of people were pouring out into the streets for a couple of months to protest his appointment. And now I should mention that the lightning rod has not totally disappeared because protests are continuing against him, even though he has officially resigned.
Lawrence, you do superb work on the influence operations that the North Koreans are running, not only in South Korea, but also inside the United States. Give us just a quick sense of what that looks like and how effective it is.
Well, in terms of the influence operations, you have pro-North Korean individuals and organizations here operating in the U.S. who portray themselves as merely peace and unification organizations, but which are, if you look at their ideology and if you look at their leading figures, are very sympathetic to the North, very hostile to the U.S. and to the traditional policies of the Republic of Korea, although they're friendly to the current government. And what's particularly troubling is some of these individuals who head up and who are members of what I term front groups, because again, they don't publicly advertise themselves as being hardcore pro-North. Some of these groups and the individuals who lead them have been in contact not only with the North Korean government itself, but with North Korean intelligence operatives who are based at the North's mission at the UN. So, for example, they will plan events in conjunction with these North Korean intelligence agents at the UN, whether it's some kind of a march in Korea or whether it's lobbying activities here. And then after having these contacts with these North Korean agents in New York, then they will go and meet with members of Congress, senators, even some administration officials to lobby them against policies which the North opposes and in favor of policies which the North hopes to see implemented here.
Keep up the good work, my friend. Come back to us soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.